In this episode of Speaking Out of Place, investigative journalist Karen Howe explains that OpenAI is anything but open. Very early on, it left behind that marketing tag to become increasingly closed and elitist. Her massive study, Empire of AI, Dreams and Nightmares in Sam Altman's OpenAI, had a rather different subtitle in its UK edition. That subtitle read, Inside the Reckless Race of Total Domination. In our conversation, we flesh out the overlap between these two points of emphasis. Howe argues that in general, the AI mission centralizes talent around a grand ambition and centralizes capital and other resources while eliminating roadblocks, regulation, and dissent. All the while, quote, the mission remains so vague that it can be interpreted and reinterpreted to direct the centralization of talent, capital, resources, however the centralizer wants, end quote. Karen explains that she chose the word empire precisely to indicate the colonial nature of AI's domination, the tremendous damage this enterprise does to the poor, to racial and ethnic minorities, and to the global South in general in terms of minds, bodies, the environment, natural resources, and any notion of democracy. This is a discussion that everyone should be part of. Speaking Out of Place is produced in collaboration with The Creative Process and is made with support from Stanford University. I alone am responsible for its content. We hope you enjoy this and other episodes. Please help support Speaking Out of Place by subscribing via our website, speakingoutofplace.com, following us on Instagram, and following me on Blue Sky. You can give me your feedback, suggest people to invite, and topics to cover. Also, please check out my book of the same title, published by Haymarket Books. Kianga Yamata Taylor calls it, quote, the exact book we need for the troubled historical moment through which we are living. Thank you so much for being on the show. I know you've been incredibly busy. You've done a ton of these kinds of podcasts and interviews, so I really appreciate you taking the time to be on yet another one. Explain to the audience the difference between AI and AGI.
Yeah, so AI is, I'll give the long explanation.
Please.
AI as a term was originally coined in 1956 to start a new discipline for recreating human intelligence in computers. It was just a couple of years after Alan Turing asked the very famous question, can machines think? And so there was this effort where scientists all came together at Dartmouth University saying, like, why don't we form a new discipline to tackle this question? And there was actually debate around what to name the discipline. And then John McCarthy, who was an assistant professor at Dartmouth at the time, said, just decided he was going to name it artificial intelligence, to the great chagrin of his mentor, who was like, this term makes no sense and it's going to confuse people because we don't know what human intelligence is. But it stuck anyway. And then later on, he said, decades later, that I invented the term artificial intelligence because I needed some money for a summer study. So he was trying to fundraise for that get together at Dartmouth University and trying to attract more attention, public attention, media attention as well. So he was very successful in doing that. And AI ended up becoming effectively a marketing term. It was a way to be evocative about something that the researchers were actually already doing under other disciplinary names. And back then, what AI meant was, yeah, this human-level intelligence. The problem is that then over the decades from 1956 all the way until present day, that term became cheapened because as more and more industries started working on AI, they started claiming we have AI already. And what they meant was not we have human intelligence already. They just meant like we have products that are able to do certain types of things that we might ascribe to intelligence. And so then AI stopped meaning human level intelligence and it just started meaning like products and services that exist today. And so then when OpenAI came along, they were like, we want to differentiate our quest from just building products and services of today. We want to return back to the original definition of AI, which is the human level intelligence. Right. And so in order to make that distinction, they use the term artificial general intelligence to make clear that they're actually still pursuing the ultimate ambition of the field. Now you can argue, are they actually pursuing the ultimate ambition in the field? Seems like they're just building products and services again. And so potentially over the next couple decades, AGI will suddenly just be synonymous with products and services and be yet another term that people will use to try and demarcate the distinction between day and the ambition.
Yeah.
Already existing things like voice recognition, things that are everybody uses and everybody's cool with, and we use it all the time. But AGI became a kind of even more human-like. And then if that becomes too mundane, they'll invest something else. So it's always, as you say, with AI in general, it was on marketing. It was to get money invested under the promise that we'll get going to deliver something that you can't even imagine, but it's going to be good no matter what it is. And so on page 400 of your book, you very usefully list three distinct points about AI, and I'll read them back to you. First, you say, the mission centralizes talent by rallying around a grand ambition. Second, the mission centralizes capital and other resources while eliminating roadblocks, regulation, and dissent. And finally, and you say most consequentially, the mission remains so vague that it can be interpreted and reinterpreted to direct the centralization of talent, capital, and resources however the centralizer wants. And I would just add something else, a fourth point that you emphasize throughout the book. In fact, you emphasize it in the title itself, which is the tremendous damage this enterprise does to the poor, to racial and ethnic minorities, to the global South in general, in terms of minds, bodies, the environment, natural resources, and any notion of democracy. This is a big question, and I'd like to have you take as much time as you want, unpack it any way you want. I'll repeat, centralization of talent, centralizing capital and resources, this open-ended nature of aims and values, and the specific and regional nature of this new empire. Just riff on that any way you want, because I think you really summarized so well.
Yeah. My book is called Empire of AI because I'm trying to articulate this argument and illustrate this argument that these companies operate exactly like empires of old. And I highlight four features that are essentially encapsulate the three things that you read, but I started talking about it a different way after writing the book. And the four features are they lay claim to resources that are not their own. So that's like the centralization of resources. They exploit an extraordinary amount of labor, both in the development of the technology and the fact that they're producing labor automating technologies that then suppress workers' ability to bargain for better rights, but not monopolize knowledge production, which comes when they centralize talent. So in the last decade, the AI industry has successfully hired most of the top AI researchers in the world out of academia. Yep. And that has distorted the scientific discipline of AI research in the same way that you would imagine climate science would be distorted if most climate scientists were bankrolled by oil and gas companies. And the final feature and parallel that I highlight is they have this existential competition narrative that they have to be an empire and a good empire because there are evil empires that exist in the world that they need to be strong enough to beat back. And the evil empire in OpenAI's imagination shifts over time. So originally it's Google, and then it becomes China. They quite literally, in this competition narrative, also engage in a religious and ideological dimension as well, which is exactly what empires of old did, where they say, we, the good empire, we are bringing progress and modernity to all of humanity. We are engaging in a civilizing mission and giving humanity the opportunity to go to heaven. And if the evil empire wins, then humanity goes to hell. And this is the kind of rhetoric that has quite literally taken hold within Silicon Valley. And I talk quite a lot about this out-religious rhetoric that has been adopted to justify these belief systems that now undergird the entire enterprise of the AI industry and its imperial expansion. So I think that's the only way to fully understand the dynamics of how the industry operates and the implications of allowing them to continue operating this way, which is, as you mentioned, the undermining of democracy around the world. Like, empires and democracies are antithetical to one another. Empires operate on a totally different logic, a hierarchical logic in which some people are born with rights that other people do not deserve. that some people are superior while others are inferior. And democracy, of course, is based on the complete opposite philosophy that everyone is equal and therefore has equal right to be part of a collectively determining the future. And Silicon Valley has never operated in that way, but they've used AI to aggressively expand their imperial ambitions is what I'm trying to highlight and point out and critique in the book.
Well, it's interesting that maybe a couple of weeks ago, I interviewed Quinn Slobodian on his book, Hayek's Bastards. And I mentioned I was going to interview you. And he said, oh, she's great. And your two books actually work quite well in tandem because he sets up the whole evangelical notion behind this neoliberal fusion between all these different elements that create this perfect storm of incredible gullibility. One thing that struck me was the folks who are behind this seem at once incredibly arrogant and incredibly naive, purposefully naive. Could you talk a little bit about the social world that you had to inhabit? Thanks for taking one for the team, because you were deep down there and professionally doing your job and getting this information, almost like to talk to you entirely separately about that experience, almost anthropologically. But talk about the social world that you found yourself in, because these are not dumb people, but they're so narrowly smart, but they claim the entirety of intelligence. Talk about your experience a bit.
Yeah, you're right that these people are highly intelligent in particular dimensions, and they are, you could argue, worldly in certain dimensions as well. But I think the problem is in STEM disciplines in general, and this is something that I felt very strongly about in undergrad, because I studied engineering in undergrad, is that there is in the culture of STEM disciplines already an establishment of hierarchy, of this idea that there are certain fields that are superior to others, and there are certain types of thought that are more rigorous than others, and certain majors or whatever that are harder than others and therefore prove that you are more intelligent if you go down that particular path. And I think Silicon Valley has always inherited a lot of that thinking, but in the AI world, and especially now, it's just gotten so much worse. It's just so much more intense, where there is this idea now that they are superior and are creating not just intellectually superior, but morally superior because of their intellect, that they are able to see far beyond what other people are able to see because they're grappling with a technology that is profoundly complex and can only lend itself to a small group of people fully grasping the depth and the implications of all of this technology. And so they've essentially worked themselves into this strange logic where they have justified they need to be imperial and that democracy shouldn't exist. And so socially, like a lot of these people, I think they're incredibly insular socially. They only ever socialize with one another, and they only ever speak with people who reflect this similar worldview, because the people who don't reflect this worldview don't survive very long in this world, because you are working and then going to parties with and living with people that are all saying the same things around this. And oftentimes the people that don't survive are the ones that are being diminished by this hierarchy. They're the ones that this hierarchy suggests are intellectually inferior, just are not seeing the profound nature of what is being developed. And that's why they can't partake in like this religious, quasi-religious belief around why it's so important as an endeavor. And they develop these vocabularies that are so unique to this community. Like the way that they talk about the world in general and AI is so specific and impenetrable if you don't spend all of your time understanding their vocabulary and their worldview. So yeah, when I was reporting it, it was hard because I had to learn a totally different set of language in order to engage with these people. And I did have to spend my own values and my own worldviews in order to probe them. I always try to meet my sources where they are, to just probe them within their world to understand why they do the things that they do. And so it was hard sometimes to do that when there's just so much happening in the world that makes you wonder, like, what the point of any of this is. Like, we have two wars waging in the world, and then you enter a conversation where you just talk these like theoretical notions of what AI could bring us. And you're like, it's so hard to continue existing in this theoretical realm when there's so much that we need to be paying attention to in like the actual world.
But Karen, you don't understand that AI will solve all the wars. You don't understand.
Exactly. No,
because time and time again in your book, you ask them perfectly straightforward follow-up questions. Like they'll say, it'll solve climate change. And you'll say, how? And they say,
yeah,
but it just will. And so the same thing would apply to anything you've put into that slot. It's just this blind faith. And the other thing that you point out is not only is the value incredibly overvalued, but the scale is incredible. In other words, the need to have higher and greater scale and amplitude and speed, which takes all this tremendous energy in every sense of the word, is the only thing that will vindicate the project. So it's like doubling down on a bad poker game.
Yeah.
The more you put in, the more you can get back. And if you don't gamble it, of course, and they're not really gambling because it's all phantom money to begin with, right?
Yeah. I think I put this quote in the book, but one of the funniest quotes I ever saw in like a Twitter exchange was, in the AI research world, there's been debate for a very long time about whether or not scaling can actually reach true advancements in human intelligence within machines, whatever human intelligence means. At one point, Ilya Sutskever tweets out something like AI, as we continue to scale, it may be slightly conscious. And what was he actually thinking when he tweeted this? I would guess that as just a scientist who is of the kind of discipline of believing that nothing is untrue until disproven, like maybe he was just suggesting we haven't proved that it's not conscious, so maybe it is a little bit conscious. But then someone responded to him and said, yeah, just scaling a field of wheat gets you to slightly more pasta. Or like, the more you scale the field of wheat, the more it starts to have pasta-like qualities. Yeah. And the point was like, no, it doesn't. It's just more wheat. Like, it's not turning more into pasta from pure quantity. And yeah, I think there's just something really bizarre and baffling about the way that the AI industry has somehow decided that pursuing this colossal scaling project is somehow going to get to fundamentally new scientific breakthroughs.
No, and it wouldn't work as a kind of enterprise if it wasn't monetized. In other words, if there wasn't a dollar figure attached to all these things as a sign of people's faith, then it would be empty promises and it wouldn't have any kind of solidity, as it were. But when people see the trillions or billions or trillions of dollars behind it, it's like the emperor's new clothes. You have people investing in it, seemingly without any bottom to their resources. Could you talk about the convergence between technology and capitalism in this sense and how the two are almost parasitic on each other in terms of the value of either?
Yeah, I think Meredith Whitaker, the president of Signal, puts it really well that hype in the tech industry is actually a feature of the venture capital model, not a bug, in that in order to develop a technology in the first place that is generally believed within the industry to be resource intensive, they have to overhype the capabilities in order to then raise a lot of money to then produce this technology. And then they enter this vicious cycle where then to then give a return on investment to the venture capitalists, they continue to hype up the technology so that they can sell the technology and give it back to the original investors. And there's this aggressive race to continue perpetuating a certain idea about what is required to build a technology and what the technology will bring us in order to keep the wheels of capitalism turning. And the problem is that with AI in particular, like this, from a technical perspective, scale is actually wholly unnecessary. And so it feels like they're just like churning money around. They continue like amassing a lot of land and resources and energy and all of the life-sustaining things that we need as a species for survival into their own hands. That's why, I call it an imperial project rather than a scientific one, because there is no technical or scientific reason for why they've taken this approach, but there certainly are political and economic ones.
Now, you mentioned it before, and I think it's pretty easy to gloss, which is the diversion of human intelligence into these projects. Students at Stanford are uniformly lining up behind, and not just at Stanford, of course, but it's the most likely place and the one that's the most talked about in some ways. But yeah, kids come in and they immediately start thinking about startups, and if not their own, but then selling their labor elsewhere, because that's a sign of they've made good on an education. You go into really gripping detail about the effects on places like Kenya and Chile in terms of the populations that we don't see. We don't recognize the cost that comes to them. Could you talk a little bit about that, how AI feeds on those resources, human and natural and political?
I guess the two biggest critiques that I lay out in the book in terms of why scale, if technically wholly unnecessary, but then has like huge, massive externalities. The two externalities that I drill into are the exploitation of labor that happens as a result of scale, as well as the environmental and public health consequences as a result of scale. So I ended up going to Kenya to interview workers that had been contracted by OpenAI to develop a content moderation filter for its models, ultimately was also used as part of ChatGPT. But the thing that OpenAI realized at the time that led them to seek this labor is they wanted to start putting their models in the hands of users. And if you're building a text generation tool that is scraped on the internet at scale, what happens is you end up gathering up a bunch of junk from the internet, and the size of your data sets is so vast that you lose comprehension of what's inside it. So no matter how much you use automated filters to try and take out that data, there's still going to be a bunch of junk in it. So then, like, when you feed that into the model, a bunch of junk is going to come out of the model as well. And they were like, well, that's not going to work if we want to make this into a compelling product. And so they asked these Kenyan workers to develop this filter that would wrap around the model and essentially block any outputs that the model might spew that would be in violation of OpenAI's content policies. And that meant that the workers had to then read reams and reams of the worst kind of text on the internet, as well as AI-generated text where OpenAI was prompting its models to generate the worst text on the internet so that they could have a greater diversity of examples. And the effect of these workers is the same thing that happened to content moderators in the social media era. They became deeply traumatized from reviewing this content. And it wasn't just the people that broke down as individuals. It was their communities that broke down, because you have a critical node in the social fabric of a community that is now troubled and socially anxious and depressed, and they can no longer provide support to the other people that used to rely on them. So that's one dimension. And again, like, the connection to the scale is the fact that the data sets have scaled to a point past comprehension. So you can't actually clean the data before it needs content moderate, like before the model needs content moderation. Whereas in the past, data sets were curated. They were built based on selecting the data that you wanted to train the model on, rather than just wholesale taking everything in. And when you're curating data, then you don't have the problem of content moderation. And the other dimension is the environmental and public health consequences. So there was a report that came out after my book published that tried to project the amount of energy that will need to be built or added onto the grid to support data center and supercomputer expansion, specifically for the AI industry. Came out from McKinsey, and it said that in the next 5 years, we would need to add 2 to 6 times the amount of energy consumed in California onto the global grid just to support the data centers. And so that is, of course, highly inefficient. Like, that's just a lot of energy that you are consuming. But then what is the energy source that you're using? It's primarily fossil fuels, primarily natural gas. So that's going to accelerate the climate crisis. It's already accelerating the climate crisis. It is leading to a bunch of air pollution being pumped into communities. And there's a Business Insider investigation I would encourage people to look at, where they actually put a numerical value on the public health costs in terms of the deterioration of air quality from the production of energy for powering these data centers. I think it's in the, it was like $9 billion or something like that in the U.S. alone. And then these data centers are often cooled with fresh water. You can also cool them without water and only energy, but then you end up using extraordinarily more amounts of energy to do that cooling, because essentially you're like running the AC really high to try and cool down these computers. Or you use fresh water, and it has to be fresh water because any other type of water quality is too corrosive or will lead to bacterial growth. And so these data centers enter into communities and most often plug into the public drinking water supply because that's the infrastructure that's available to deliver fresh water to the facility. So I ended up going to Chile to look at that specific dimension of an exacerbating an already existing public health crisis. There is not enough fresh water in the world right now. And Bloomberg had an investigation that found that 2/3 of these data centers for AI are actually going into water scarce areas where there's already not enough fresh water for the communities. And so I went to Chile, I went to Uruguay, where both countries were facing a historic level of drought, already experiencing significant stressors on their fresh water supply. And then in the midst of that, Google tried to enter both countries to build these massive data centers that they proposed to use extraordinary amounts of fresh water. And ultimately, in those cases, it's a rather heartening story because then both communities fought back relentlessly to protect that freshwater resource and actually were able to make some gains to block the projects and get the companies to reconsider their plans. But again, it's directly derivative of the scaling approach that they need so much infrastructure that they're entering into places that actually cannot support the consumption that is required.
Now, I definitely want to actually end the podcast down the road with talking about some of these remarkable victories, because you think about they're battling against governments that are largely complicit. In other words, they're fighting this uphill battle against political parties that have their own prerogatives, et cetera, et cetera. And if you think about what an incredible diversion of energy that is too, right? These people are having to fight their own government for their basic environmental rights or their civil rights, when that energy could be put into so many different things. But before we get there, one thing at least I wanted to talk to you about, which is backing up a step, the whole idea of open AI and the way it was sold as being this benevolent, forward-looking, humanifying enterprise. And then you point out that soon enough, there became sort of two camps. There were the boomers and the doomers. So talk about these two supposedly different camps. And then in the course of your book, you show how they fuse together in an interesting way. So talk about that, because I think that it's almost like the notion of a cloud, which seems so amorphous and in the ether, literally, or not literally, but figuratively. But people buy into this notion that it's unearthed from the solidity of the physical world, which of course it's not, as you just pointed out. But talk about how there was some skepticism, if not fear, but then that was a healthy thing. But then there was also this notion, but we have to go as far as we can. So talk about these two different camps and how they ultimately ended up.
Yeah, the thing that I was most surprised by when I was reporting the book is I thought that we hear in the public these very simplified narratives about AI. AI is going to bring us utopia or dystopia. And I thought that was just rhetorical. Like, the industry has just been very successful in rhetorically convincing people that there is this binary, and ultimately both all contribute to the idea that AI is very powerful and therefore should be controlled by a small group of people. And so it's just their way to continue perpetuating their own consolidation and control. What I was surprised by is realizing that it's not just rhetoric, that there are people who genuinely believe this. And I describe it as quasi-religious beliefs because they are not based in any scientific evidence. It's not like they're doing research and seeing conclusive evidence about what is going to come to pass. It's not like they're sampling impacts around the world. And there's no rigor around these conclusions. They're simply just beliefs. And they talk about them using the language of belief, saying that they are artificial general intelligence believers and so on. But they do split into these two camps. The boomers are the ones that think that they're going to go to utopia, and the doomers think that AI could, in its worst case scenario, kill all of humanity. And what I concluded was they're actually two sides of the same coin, because ultimately they both believe that AI, AGI, it's possible, it's inevitable, it's going to be civilizationally transformative. And their only disagreement is whether it's going to be in the positive or negative direction. And sometimes people are both. Sometimes people actually think that there is a one turn the right way will suddenly bring us to utopia. One turn the wrong way will suddenly kill everyone. And the doomers are much more interesting and complex, in that the boomers are like, this is going to bring us to utopia. We just need to build it as quickly as possible. And then we got to release it. And that's going to get us to utopia faster. The doomers are more complex in that they splinter off themselves into people who think we need to build this as fast as possible so that we can then have a head start on bad actors that might be building this as well, and then figure out how to contain this technology before they try to unleash a terrible version onto the world. And then other doomers think we need to just get rid of this enterprise altogether and just stop building AGI. And essentially, regardless of where you sit within the spectrum of different beliefs, they all ultimately work to perpetuate the imperial nature of AI development, because they, in at their core, all believe, again, that there has to be a centralized control of this technology because it is so supremely powerful, and because the stakes are so high, can bring humanity to heaven or can bring it to hell. And so they each, in their own ways, even though the doomers say they're actually trying to prevent AI from unfettered acceleration, like, they actually work hand in hand with the boomers to accelerate this technology in this all-out race towards dominance. And the thing that actually worried me the most when I was reporting the book is, like, when someone is doing something purely in a more Machiavellian sense, I think it feels like the solution's a little bit more obvious. But when people are doing it because of deep-seated religious beliefs and ideological drive, then it's, like, much more complicated how to actually convince them to stop, because how do you talk someone out of their religion?
No, exactly. And it goes back to something you said earlier on, which is that, of course, they're the ones that are going to make the determination, because they're the only ones smart enough to do it. And if you put it in the hands of even political leaders, of course, they don't know shit about anything. And it just wastes time when we could be saving the world from any number of things. Just give us the room and space to do it and trust us, essentially. And time and again, in your book, you say, to trust you, we need some answers. And they say, just trust me. It becomes, again, very circular, very evangelical. What's your take on the recent Anthropic lawsuit and settlement? Some people have cautioned us not to read too much into it. But what do you make of it? And how might it be indicative of some of the key issues going forward? What are your thoughts?
That's a good question. The judge created this interesting fine line where the training itself was fine, but the storage of the material was not. And I haven't actually read the lawsuit judgment, so I can't speak in depth about exactly what happened, but I did think that it was just an interesting take. And the fact that Anthropic then settled suggests to me that they maybe just did not really see benefit to having a really drawn out case where they would potentially have to open up a lot of documents and open up a lot of details about how they actually train their models. It's also interesting that they settled, I think, exactly a day before they then announced that they are going to start training on user chats. I don't have any insider insight into the timing, but just from the outside, it seems like they might have settled in part because they knew that they wanted to make this transition. So they didn't want to be litigating this while also doing that. So yeah, I guess overall, like, maybe my take, not on this lawsuit in particular, but, like, on the question of training data and whether it's fair use, my personal take is that it's not fair use. Like, these are people's work outputs, intellectual outputs, creative outputs that are then being used to develop models that can become substitutes for that. And I'm not a lawyer, but my understanding of copyright law is that's exactly what it was meant to protect, was just the ripping and infringement of intellectual and creative work to create substitutes that would then ultimately diminish the original creator's economic opportunity. And I think that's exactly what's happening here. But I do think that the companies have been very clever in miring a lot of the conversation and technicalities that are not actually that important in terms of the broader stroke of what's happening. And Anthropic's moves are just showing yet more of the logic of what ultimately powers the industry, which is they need ever more data. And so if you allow copyright law to capitulate, they don't stop there. They're going to keep moving to seize other domains of data for developing their systems.
Your book is so useful because when the case broke, I was already preconditioned to be skeptical based on all the things that you uncovered, which is if all of this seems to follow a pattern of great bombastic headlines and huge triumph of this, and my gosh, good will outweigh evil. But behind the scenes, there are exactly those kinds of operations that are slicing and dicing and diverting so that it was not a shot across the bow, but almost a practice run at what these companies do, right? So you could almost see it as being useful to them, right? They know what the game and play might be. So I want to really focus on the epilogue. I love the epilogue. I'm so glad you ended with that because you said it's a response to the notion that data is the last frontier of colonization. And you talk about a number of really important ways in which AI is used for good, not good in the marketing way, but as we said early in the show, for redistributing power. Could you talk about those examples? Because a lot of people say, I just want to throw out everything. Certainly, it has to be some good. And we're saying, no, it's about the people that are using it and the ends to which it's put, and you can't trust capitalists. Good to them has a very particular formation. But talk about the epilogue, please.
Yeah, so I opened the epilogue with the story of this organization called Te Hiku Media, which is a Maori nonprofit radio station in New Zealand. And this was a story that I reported several years ago that just has stuck with me over time because they were trying to help support the revitalization of the Maori language, Te Reo Maori. And like many indigenous peoples, the Maori peoples suffered sort of the same fate over the last two generations where they almost lost their language because of racist assimilation policies after colonization. So the British colonized New Zealand and then it would beat kids if they tried to speak Maori in schools. And so there's been this huge effort nationwide and among the Maori people to try and reclaim their language and find that lost language again. And the problem is that there are just not that many proficient Maori speakers anymore because of this challenge. So there's not that many Maori teachers. And Te Hiku Media, as a Maori radio station, is unique in that they do all of their interviews in Te Reo Maori. So they have this rich archive of, I think, some 30 years of audio in their language. And they thought, this is a resource that we can actually open up to our community so that more Maori learners can hear this audio and, in fact, hear some of their ancestors speaking pre-colonization, where their speech has not yet been distorted by the sounds of English. And so then they thought, okay, in order to do that, to make it into an interactive educational tool, then we would need to transcribe these sounds into words that people can see, that they can click on to then get a little pop-up that says the meaning of that word so that they can actually like interact and learn the language through this. But then you come to the problem of they don't have enough speakers to transcribe this audio because there's not enough speakers at the level of proficiency that is required for some of these really complex interviews. So they thought we can turn to a speech recognition tool. So they wanted to build an AI tool to resolve this problem. They approached developing their AI tool in a fundamentally different way from the way that the AI industry operates. First of all, they started with a problem, a very well-scoped one that this would be an important thing for our community to overcome. Let's build a technology to resolve this challenge rather than what the AI industry does, which is just let's advance AI and advance technical progress for technical progress's sake and then end up in a situation where we're trying to find product market fit.
Yeah.
And the second thing that they did was they then asked the community, do you want this AI tool? And once the community consented, then they explained to the community, this is what AI would require. We would need data. Can we get your consent to, can you donate data to our project? And this is the way that we would want the data to be formatted. So they had a highly curated data set in the end that was very small because it was so very high quality. And they were able to then train a very small task-specific AI model that did speech recognition in Te Reo Māori. And they then were able to iteratively improve on the model. I think the first training run led to a model that was around 86% accurate. So it was already pretty good. And then they used it to transcribe a bunch of archival audio and then fix the transcriptions and then feed it back into the model and keep improving the quality. They also went about doing this project in a way that would train more Māori data scientists so that there would be a new generation of technical talent that could continue building AI tools for the community. So they would hire interns to train them up on, like, how do you develop AI? How do you curate the data? How do you train these systems? How do you set up the hardware and so on? So that they could continue expanding the pool of talent that would be needed to perpetuate these projects. And then the last thing that they did was they asked all of the data that they collected, they wrote a legally binding license such that if anyone ever asks for access to the data, they have to sign this legally binding license to say that they will only use it in certain ways and not others. Ultimate goal being that they don't want this data to then drift towards purposes that will ultimately harm the Māori community or subvert the values that are important to the community. And that essentially allows them to continue governing the use of their biometric data, like their voice data, towards things that will continue to shift power in the right way,
yeah,
to redistribute it. Yeah. And that, to me, is like the exact example of how we should actually think about the potential that this technology could have if we want more equality, more sustainability, more human rights, and more democracy in the world. It's a consensual, participatory, democratic approach to AI development, where it is literally trying to right historic wrongs rather than exacerbate them. Over time, I have realized that in order to actually get to a point where AI is serving people rather than people being served up to AI models is to have these much more community-driven AI development efforts, these much more small AI models that are task-specific, targeting these well-scoped challenges, rather than engaging in this nebulous project using an everything machine that is supposed to be a one-size-fits-all solution for anyone.
Yeah, your book does such a great job about, as I said earlier, building skepticism. In other words, to say, no, this is not worth the price of admission. The way these things work, you demystify them in a really important way. That's the key, right? Is to understand what went into the making of all of this, what the hype was, what was going on behind the scenes. And that's an incredible tool that you've given us. So I just really wanted to thank you again for being on the show and spending time with us. And I hope to have you back again.
Thank you so much, David.
Take care.
Bye.